Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans and this is episode 12 of the COVID Chronicles. My guest, as usual, Dr. Saria Sikosia, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And let me start off by saying that when we recorded last week's episode, I don't think that we thought when we recorded this week's episode that COVID-19 might not be the biggest news story in the country.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. So a lot has changed over the last week, and certainly not that the coronavirus pandemic is an afterthought at this point, but it's been overshadowed at the very least by some other things going on. And that's actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about with all of these protests that we're seeing around the nation. And I don't necessarily want to get into the politics and the specifics of why the protests are happening, but certainly with all that you and I have talked about over the last several weeks about social distancing and making sure that people stay safe when they're out, these kinds of protests are bringing people together. And even the images that you see on TV, people are wearing masks, but they're also standing elbow to elbow. And is that enough? Is this part of the second wave that could be happening? What do you think about all of this development in terms of the coronavirus pandemic?
Chris, it is concerning. In fact, it has certainly complicated the COVID-19 challenges that we're seeing today.
Which were challenging enough already.
That's right. So COVID-19 certainly has not gone away. In fact, what we're seeing as of this week is not only an increase in the number of cases, but also the number of hospitalizations. And why that's important is because we have, in the state of South Carolina, in partnership with DHEC, really focused efforts on expanding our testing capability, reaching out to our communities where they need us most. For example, last week we tested over 900 people in the upstate at our community testing sites. And what we've discovered is a higher rate of COVID-19 positives. So that does complicate the picture when you have individuals who are protesting. Some of the pictures that I have seen show that many people are wearing masks. However, there are still many people who are not wearing masks. And it's incredibly challenging to social distance while you're protesting in some of these spaces. I certainly support everyone's rights to do so. And I just hope that we do this safely with the appropriate social distancing. The numbers of positives we're seeing today that are positive and that number increasing is likely due to, as I mentioned a moment ago, an increase in community testing. But if you think back a couple of weeks ago, we had a holiday. We had Memorial Day and many more people were out. Now, I anticipate over the next couple of weeks, we can possibly see another bump in the rates of COVID-19 because of the protests and the lack of social distancing in some cases, and where some folks have not been wearing masks and their risk.
So I think you kind of mentioned this, but I want to make a point out of it. The number of cases that we've had in South Carolina and indeed the nation and the world has been increasing always. I mean, it's kept going up, but you're talking about an increase in the rate of increase that we're actually kind of ramping back up in terms of maybe even seeing that second spike or second wave that we were worried about.
That's correct. We are seeing not only an increased number in the cases, but the rate of the increase that we're seeing for COVID-19 cases has also gone up. In particular, as we've reached out to our communities that are Hispanic predominantly, we're seeing increased rates of positive COVID-19 for some of these communities. And so it's so important that we're reaching out to help them understand risks that are associated to not being able to social distancing, workplace safety, and ensuring that they are able to wear masks and have their distance. As we are in other communities, we're also seeing additional risks to patients. But now with the increase in cases of hospitalizations locally in the upstate, but not necessarily across the entire state, we need to be very sensitive to our community and that increased risk for exposure at this time.
Well, and I also want to ask about increases in Hispanic population. It's not necessarily that there is anything racially or ethnically specific about Hispanics that we know of that would make them more susceptible to the virus. It's more that as a community, they may have practices or behaviors that are riskier than others.
That's right. In fact, what we've recognized and are grateful for through our community testing, the knowledge that we have gained, is that we need to do a better job as a community reaching out to our Hispanic population. We're partnering with the United Way and many other community organizations such as PASOS to make sure we're getting the message out, answering questions. Those who are Spanish-speaking, making sure they have the same access to care and understanding of COVID-19 as an illness as everyone else in our community.
You know, this actually brings up a question that I was going to ask later, but it's so apropos, I think, at this point. One of the articles that I had read this week was about Brazil reporting high infection rates in their indigenous populations, the populations that don't necessarily have a lot of contact with other societies. And the idea that history is rife with any number of examples of indigenous populations meeting explorers or settlers and then catching illnesses that they were not previously exposed to. Is there something about having been exposed to a variety of illnesses that would help people be less susceptible to a COVID-19 infection in particular? Or is there something else about these populations that's making them particularly susceptible?
As of today, I have not read any materials that supports or validates that linkage.
Okay.
That may be something we learn in the future, and why it's so important that we are addressing the needs of our different types of communities and making sure that we have health equity across all ethnic groups.
We were talking about this possibility of a second wave, and another one of the articles that I had seen and something that became sort of a point of contention. Apparently, there was an Italian doctor that had described the coronavirus as losing potency. And then the World Health Organization came out and said, no, it isn't actually losing potency. It's still just as deadly as ever. We still need to pay attention to it. I got the impression from the articles that they were not exactly talking about the same thing, like they were kind of talking past each other, and that it was they weren't necessarily disagreeing. I think the Italian doctor was referring to the pandemic as a whole in Italy is kind of subsiding, rather than the virus individually affecting a particular person and could still kill them. And that's what the WHO had to clarify.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. That's my understanding as well. What's interesting, though, and let's spend a little time talking about that, as some may hear that or interpret that decrease in potency, to your point, that the virus has changed. And while we may see some mutation of the virus, it's probably not because the actual mortality rate has changed per se. What has changed, that mortality number that we've been viewing, is initially we had more limitations and restrictions for testing. Now that we've been testing more widely and understand that anywhere between 38% to 44% of cases of COVID-19 are from asymptomatic carriers, we're recognizing that there are many people walking around that if you test them would be positive for COVID-19. They may not appear to be ill themselves, but are definitely responsible for transmitting the virus to others. So the CDC last week released some data where we had originally thought the overall mortality rate for COVID-19 was approximately 1.3%. They've adjusted that number to 0.4%. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is any less deadly as a virus. It's just that there are so many people who are walking around with COVID-19 that we were not aware of until we were able to enhance our testing capabilities here in South Carolina
and across
the country.
Right. And we've talked before about the asymptomatic nature of this particular virus and that a lot of people could be carrying it and never show any symptoms, but they could still be spreading it to other people who will develop symptoms, maybe even serious symptoms. And that especially early on, when there was such a small portion of testing equipment for people, it was generally not used on people who didn't have any symptoms.
Exactly. That is what we are seeing. And we are also learning more and more about the symptoms of COVID-19, where originally the entire focus was on respiratory symptoms, if you will, and including fever. And now we're seeing a constituency or a large group of individuals where the only symptom they have is loss of smell or loss of taste, and then they're testing positives. We didn't know that originally when we were collecting data to begin with, but now that picture is changing. We're picking up on new symptoms such as myalgias or muscle aches, as well sore throat, where we might have associated that with some other type of illness. We are much more suspicious of those symptoms and testing more generously in those cases.
Is that typical of other illnesses? Do things, COVID-19 has been compared frequently, I think because of its pandemic nature, to influenza, which is kind of a broad category of viruses, whereas COVID-19 is a specific virus in the coronavirus family. But is that sort of secondary symptom characteristic of other illnesses that that people get, or is it just COVID that we're learning about?
Yes, and flu is a good example for that. We do see that a significant number of patients that are infected with the flu may also have GI symptoms or vomiting or diarrhea. So that is that's important to make that linkage and that connection between other respiratory viruses that may also have side effects to other symptoms, like GI-related symptoms.
You're talking about the testing that we're doing, the increased testing, and I had looked at some recent numbers from the both the CDC and South Carolina DHEC. CDC reporting that the cases in the United States, confirmed cases in the United States, approaching 2 million, just under 2 million at the time of this recording, and that the deaths in the United States are just over 110,000, but we've done 19.5 million tests. That's basically 10 times as many tests as we have confirmed cases, or put another way, 10% of the tests that we've done have resulted in confirmed cases, and I guess the other 90% tested negative. What should we make of those numbers?
So interestingly, you mentioned the 10% number, and for many weeks now in the upstate, our positive rate of people who were being tested was approximately 10%. And many weeks it was 10.5%, 10.6%. Well, that number has increased to 13% recently. So that's another indicator that not only are we testing more people, we're testing more generously, and we are also seeing an increase in those local hospitalizations in the upstate. So for many reasons, we're seeing that rate increase.
And I just want to reiterate that those are recent tests. The tests that we've performed recently have that increased rate, because the numbers that I have from DHEC are basically an aggregate over the entire pandemic. 13,000 cases. We've just topped that number here in South Carolina of 13,000 confirmed cases, but we've tested, they say, 239,000 cases, which would definitely be under that 10% mark rather than over it. So you're talking about recent tests that we've done have shown an increased positive rate.
That's correct. That is a new change over the last couple of weeks where we're seeing this increase.
Well, and this kind of brings us back around, I think, to the question of a second spike and reopening. You know, as we're reopening, the admonition has been be careful, continue the precautions like social distancing, like mask wearing, like hand washing, things like that, because we could experience a second wave or a second spike. Is there any reason so far to think that even if we did have a second spike, that it would be worse than the first one?
So I wouldn't say that the second spike would be any worse than the first one. What's different is our ability to combat the illness. We're much more prepared than we were originally when this novel coronavirus approached the U.S.
It did kind of catch us by surprise, didn't it?
That's right. It did catch us by surprise. And since that date, we've had the opportunity to invest in resources and support and connect with community in ways that we weren't able to do when we first experienced this back in March. So we're well prepared. And as we talk about this potential increase in cases, I think it is important for our listeners to be aware that we still have adequate capacity in our hospitals. We still have plenty of hospital beds. We have plenty of ventilators to take care of these patients. However, it's just as important today, if not more important, that it was several weeks ago, that we maintain our social distancing. The masks are very helpful, considering we have more and more people who are out and about in our communities, and the increase in the number of exposures you have increases your likelihood of being exposed and contracting the illness. So we still have to maintain vigilance. We are not through the COVID-19 pandemic. We're still right in the middle of it.
Speaking of the number of patients hospitalized, DHEC is reporting 453 patients across the state. Again, at the time of this recording, 453 patients across the state that are hospitalized with COVID-19. Our news department wanted to know if you can tell us how many people at Prisma are hospitalized with COVID-19 and how many are in the ICU? How many are those critical cases?
Well, what I can share with you, Chris, is that number is constantly changing.
Sure.
I don't have those specific data points today. And as soon as I shared, then it would be outdated.
That's the nature of this program.
Right. But at least we have discussed the directional movement we're seeing and the increasing cases. And we're paying very close attention and ensuring that we have adequate resources in place so that we can take good care of these patients and make sure they receive the best care possible.
You mentioned the way that we respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, and I assume that that includes not just the active responses that we have, doctors like yourself and others at Prisma Health, you know, actively treating cases and the precautions that we take, but also one of the things that I came across this week was a study in Spain that was talking about herd immunity, and the study found that Spain in particular is nowhere close to having a herd immunity yet. I think we've touched on the topic of herd immunity before, but I don't know that we've ever really discussed it in depth. Can you start with describing what herd immunity means for our listeners?
Yes, herd immunity refers to the protection of a society based on vaccination rates most often, which have to be significantly high, oftentimes in the 80% range, 90% range is what we see, particularly with our childhood immunizations, but also exposure and protection. What we have learned is just because you've been exposed to COVID-19 does not mean you're protected in any sense. And so herd immunity relies on people being protected by keeping a low infection rate in a community by having people already exposed previously or immunized to protect them with the antibodies or the defense system available to combat the disease as soon as they're exposed to it. So again, nowhere near herd immunity. And what I'm learning is that until we have vaccines available, there's no way there will be enough people exposed, nor have we received any insurance, if you will, that even if you've been exposed, that you can't be reinfected.
Well, and even given the numbers that we're seeing of confirmed cases in the United States, 2 million, again, roughly 2 million as of the time of this recording, that's nowhere near 80 to 90% of the population. Even if it were 10 times that, you know, that we've only confirmed 10% of cases and the actual number of infected people is 10 times that, that's only 20 million. That's still not anywhere close to 80 to 90% of the population.
Not even close.
So that kind of answers my next question, I guess, is as to whether there's any indication about herd immunity here in South Carolina or here in the upstate. It's not something that is even an option yet and probably won't be until, as you said, we get a vaccine.
That's correct, for many years to come. And when you look at the flu vaccine, the best chance we have to prevent the flu is to receive that vaccine. And while we're very hopeful for the opportunity of a COVID-19 vaccine to be available to us in the future, as we know, it would not be anytime soon. In fact, while some are hopeful that it'll be within the year, that would be the most rapid cycle of recognition of a disease and development of an efficacious vaccine in that amount of time.
Well, and relating to the flu vaccine, a lot of people will complain about the efficacy rate of that being, I think numbers usually put it around somewhere around 15 to 20%. But even then, it's 15 to 20% less likely than you would have been if you hadn't had it.
That is true. That is true. The more people who have the flu vaccine, the more protected communities are. It's not 100%. That is right. But the more that has it, the better. And we know because of the mortality rate being higher for COVID-19 than it is for the flu, we will definitely want to make sure that vaccine is on board as soon as we have access to one.
So with everything that we've discussed regarding things opening back up and, you know, a potential of a second wave, how is Prisma handling things internally in terms of people coming back to the hospital? Actually, one of the questions that I had for you is how is Prisma doing with reopening? I know that for a while you had people working from home. There were some staff that were sent away from the hospital and only critical staff were allowed in. How are things going at Prisma in terms of getting back to normal?
More of our team members are back in the offices. However, we still have individuals working from home. We also try to follow the same advice that we're recommending to our communities from a social distancing perspective. We continue to have many meetings as conference calls rather than face-to-face when appropriate. So we're still being very mindful of the process. Also, as we return back learners to the environment, for example, medical students have recently returned. We're trying to gradually bring back those different groups of learners, such as nurses and technologists and all other types of learners within our community. And from a standpoint for patients, our surgery volumes have returned to almost normal. We've identified safe and effective ways to make this allowable so that patients who need the care are receiving the care in a timely manner, so we're not holding off for care that has been deferred and absolutely needs to occur. I do encourage people to continue to consider virtual visits or video visits.
Yeah,
this is still an option that I think is very helpful, especially for individuals who are over the age of 65, individuals who are high risk. Virtual visits can be more convenient and can limit your risk and exposure of being out in our communities and going around town. So again, those virtual visits are still available and all of our practices remain open for in-person visits when appropriate, but consider video still as a viable option.
Well, and I remember talking with you in the first couple of episodes of this program when we were first starting out in March about telehealth kind of becoming more popular as an option than it had been before all of this coronavirus stuff got started. And I wonder from you, is there a sense that any of this is preferable, that people might prefer, you know, the virtual visits, or that people at Prisma, some of your employees might prefer working from home, and that these policies will continue even after COVID-19 has come and gone?
Yes. In fact, we continue to receive feedback from patients that they very much appreciate this offering. I was in a meeting earlier today where one of our clinicians was sharing a story of an 85-year-old who said, "I never want to go into the office again. This is so convenient to receive this care." And we also have younger people who are using this service so they don't have to take off of work. There is so much that we can do connected through technology, and we continue to hear that feedback across the country broadly and widely, but also these personal stories from patients who've had the opportunity to connect with their provider through technology and through a video visit. It's been much appreciated.
And if you need to get some information on how to handle those virtual visits or how to set them up, you can go to prismahealth.org/access. There's all kinds of information there about how to schedule a virtual visit. They've even got a link to the Prisma Health Go app, which, again, will help arrange all of that. We've talked a little bit about the testing, the increased testing that we're seeing in South Carolina and across the country and across the world. What are the options for testing as far as Prisma Health is concerned, Doctor?
We still have our drive-through testing tent available, and we have continued our community testing sites. I mentioned earlier during our conversation that we tested over 900 individuals in the upstate. And that is why these community testing sites, whether you're symptomatic or asymptomatic, we take all comers to this site. Our drive-through testing tent still requires a provider's order and for symptomatic testing purposes. And for our personal team members and first responders, we also have a separate testing site available for those individuals. And we very much appreciate the services that they're providing to our community and want to ensure they have adequate access as well.
And if nothing else, you can visit prismahealth.org/coronavirus to find out more information about that. And of course, 1063WORD.com for general coronavirus news that isn't necessarily related to health or Prisma in particular, but is more sort of news-oriented. Dr. Saria Sicosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health, has again been my guest today. Thank you so much for being on this program so often, Doctor.
I'm glad to join you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
It's been my pleasure. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.